Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Here now, another story selected from the pages of Asimov's science fiction magazine.
In Jay O'Connell's The Gorgon, a job-obsessed businessman accidentally wanders into an online realm of horror and intrigue. Enjoy this tale, narrated and written by Jay O'Connell.
Sandra broke into my weekly senior management conference call. Connor Murphy is here? Sandra had that annoying every statement sounds like a question thing going on. If she hadn't been good at her job, I'd have axed her for it. He says he's giving 2 weeks' notice? This was the first I'd heard that Murphy was unhappy. This was bad. Send him in, I said. I bowed out of the call and I scanned Murphy's file. Glanced at his social media feed and opened my door to beckon him inside. He took my hand after a moment's hesitation and gave it a diffident squeeze. He slumped into the chair opposite my desk and checked his smartwatch. Typical Murphy. Murphy was a software architect, and according to reports, he was doing a top-notch job. Rank-and-file code monkeys loved him because he was one of them, and they knew it. He wasn't interested in the contributions of other departments, and he held our C-level in contempt. But that was common amongst our developers. I guessed he'd personally added at least 20 million to Census Inc.'s bottom line over the last few years, for a small fraction of that in salary and benefits. He looked tired, a little haunted. So yeah, I'm given notice. He arched his brows and made a little smile. What did you want to talk about? He was doing this thing, picking at his thumb knuckles with the forefinger of each hand. He had ugly calluses at the first joint. They were bleeding. He didn't notice this, so I ignored it too. You have personal days? I checked his file. 10 of them. Why not take a few? Do some hiking. His social media feed was full of striking mountaintop views. See how you feel in a few days. He laughed at me. Yeah. Hiking isn't going to help. I thought you were happy here, I said. He shrugged. I was. Look, it's personal. Has anyone been giving you trouble? I dealt with Murphy's little issues before. We'd bonded over our mutual disinterest in the mandated sensitivity training, triggered by his use of an Indian accent in teleconferences with an offshore development team. I impressed on him the seriousness of the complaint, and he had retired the accent without attending the course. After we had both agreed, his accent was dead on. Nobody's bothering me, he said. It's not about that, he sighed. You wouldn't get it. Try me. He shook his head. I don't want to insult you, but you wouldn't get it. He thought I was too stupid to understand. Tell you what I'm going to do. We'll have Sandra draw up the paperwork, but we won't file it until next week. Humor me? He looked up at the ceiling for a second. Fine, he said. Look, I'm sorry. What is that thing they say? It's not you, it's me. Maybe you could have a drink after work on Friday, I said. Maybe I can help you think this through. He stopped, picking his thumbs. Is that appropriate? I'm the head of HR. I spread my hands. He laughed and ran his fingers through thinning hair. Now, Murphy wasn't in the closet, but he kept his private life private at work. But he hadn't kept his life out of his feed. He seemed to have a thing for silver-haired older men who kept themselves in shape. Like me. His gaze had snagged on the framed family portrait propped up on my desk. The shot was 4 years old. Victoria had cut and dyed her shoulder-length hair into a purple bob, pierced her nose, and moved out. She was at SUNY Purchase now, studying something fun and useless. My wife Carol looked much the same as in the shot, thin and pretty and exhausted by her marketing career, and the young yoga instructor we all pretended was just a yoga instructor. I glanced down at the photo and gave a little shrug. I smiled warmly. My bottom line was the census bottom line. Murphy had played hardball when my predecessor hired him, and his non-compete was garbage. I'd lobbied senior management and gotten the entire legal department canned over how crappy it was. But in Murphy's case, the damage was done. In 2 years, he could be working for one of our competitors in an adjacent market space. Census was currently focused on equity trading systems, but Murphy's skills were fungible in many industries, and he could damage us, block our expansion to other lines. And Murphy had started companies in the last bubble, and the market was heating up again. I held a lot of Census stock. I had yet to vest in my options. I was going to have to deal with the Murphy problem, one way or another. Connor's an effing genius, pardon my French, Adya confessed over her black bass, mussels, and parsnips at Gramercy Tavern. She swirled a claret-red wine in her glass. This is lovely. What is it? I needed better intel on Murphy before we had drinks on Friday. Adya was a senior developer with stellar peer reviews, and I knew she liked me. It's a 2002 Barolo Pira. Not a wine person, even I could appreciate its flavor. Bright tannins nearly buried beneath an avalanche of dense fruitiness. The Barolo Pira wasn't subtle, nor was it meant to be. I feel underdressed. Adya glanced surreptitiously around the dining room. She was. Both her forest green gabardine pants and pullover top had seen better days. Her low-heeled shoes looked less expensive than the waitstaff's. You look fine, I said, which was also true. She was a striking woman, with a placid, penetrating gaze and glossy black hair done up in a bun. During my weekly golfing outing with Driscoll, our CTO, Adya's name had come up as an alternative to Murphy in the company's upcoming MCP effort. MCP would be the unification of a dozen machine learning projects into a single composite capable of managing a broad array of processes outside the financial sector. Adya smiled and sipped her wine. I urged another glass on her to finish the bottle, and she accepted it gracefully. Forgive me if this is a stupid question, but do architects write much code? My understanding was that architects supervised teams, deciding on tools and platforms, helped analysts develop requirements and set performance metrics. Adya laughed. He's the kind of architect that codes the tricky bits himself. He leaves us the stuff that bores him. We do integrations, Q&A, and cleanup. God, I probably shouldn't be telling you all this. She polished off her wine. What would it do to development timelines if we had to replace Murphy? Adya frowned. Is that likely? I shook my head. Oh no, this is due diligence. But we have to explore contingencies. Would you be interested in taking Murphy's place? I mean, if it came to that? Adya stopped chewing and set down her fork. If Census can't retain Connor, I would be willing to take on his role until the company found another architect. But you want my honest opinion? Of course. On that day, I'd start looking for work elsewhere, perhaps at Connor's new company? This was the flip side to the new social contract. Those with in-demand skills often had zero company loyalty. I paid the bill with the company credit card and passed on her invitation to continue the evening with drinks on the town. She looked disappointed as we shared a ride back to her apartment, where I declined the nightcap while reassuring her how much the company valued her work, how much I appreciated her insight. I spent the next 2 days pinging headhunters and agencies looking for Murphy's replacement. I sent a few headhunter friends Murphy's way to see what he might be looking for in a new job. My conversations with stakeholders company-wide revealed Murphy's input as being vital at many levels. He could be brusque and difficult, but his influence in every project surfaced as I noted the coworkers and managers who had taken credit for his ideas. Murphy was, in a word, uniquely irreplaceable. Well, that's two words, but you know what I mean. Victoria called late Thursday afternoon. Even knowing it would be disappointing news, her voice on the line made me smile. "Can't come up," she said. "I'm totally swamped. I'm going to be stuck in the library all weekend as it is." The friend finder in her mobile confirmed that she was in her dorm room. The tracker I had secretly embedded in her dental work disagreed. The map on my desktop screen flashed a blue dot, a mile from campus, in a rundown suburb where graduate students rented dilapidated multifamily homes. Victoria, like Murphy and my wife, thought she was smarter than I was. And I hoped she would be one day. I'd bumped into my own limitations in my second-rate public high school, so I'd used deep learning apps to translate plagiarized content into my wooden writing style and purchased my answers to the college boards. I figured learning to navigate BlackNet was a better investment in my time and energy than memorizing Common Core curricula. My parents struggled heroically and futilely to make a better life for me and my sister. My father had come from money, but had been too proud to ask for help. I paid for my BlackNet wares by liquidating heirlooms I stole from my grandparents' estate in the Berkshires. I hired a black rabbit to stage a break-in to cover my tracks. I'm about the ends, not the means. I enjoy finding the shortest line between any two points. I worried about being a sociopath throughout college. My marriage to Carol and my use of her inheritance to fund my graduate education didn't alleviate that concern. Still, I'd read that true sociopaths don't worry about being sociopaths. Then came Victoria. I felt something holding the tiny newborn in my arms. A thing I'd never felt for Carol, for my parents, for my sister, or for any of my so-called friends. I went into therapy shortly thereafter, hoping this feeling might be metabolic, pheromones, hoping the horrific sense of vulnerability would fade with time. It hasn't. I don't think it ever will. "I understand," I told Victoria. "Don't push yourself too hard. We'll see you at Thanksgiving." She hadn't told me about the boyfriend, the one the secret security detail had identified. He'd checked out as harmless, but the situation made me itchy. Two young women had been abducted from Victoria's campus in as many months. One body had been found dumped in a nearby national park. Victoria had flat-out refused an impromptu European tour or a month of distance learning from home. Victoria wasn't a victim. She was smart as a whip. Her spoofing of her geolocation through the routing of her mobile suggested that our minds worked in similar ways. This didn't make me love her any less, but it made me nervous. "Be careful," I said. "Don't go out alone. Travel in groups. Don't walk. Use your ride card." "I know, Dad. I know." I could hear her eyes rolling. When she was three, she jimmied a child lock during a cocktail party, evaded her nanny, and slipped into our backyard pool. Carol had simply screamed, rooted to the spot, as I dived in and fished out her limp body and given her CPR. When she'd come back to me, spewing pool water down my throat, I'd thanked a God I'd never believed in and didn't believe in again 30 minutes later. I had her chip installed that week and reinstalled when her adult teeth came in. "I'm sorry about missing the weekend, but I'm super busy. Gotta run. Love you," Victoria said. "Ditto," I replied. I picked Murphy up outside his crappy apartment building in one of the limos that Census Inc. used for ferrying VIPs back and forth to the airport. Murphy was still clad in business casual, tan khakis and a blue button-down shirt, but he'd thrown a blue blazer over the ensemble and slicked back his hair with product. For a geek, he was in reasonable shape, but his silhouette had been permanently rounded by week-long code orgies, pounding energy drinks, and programmer chow, the free junk food available in any high-tech sweatshop. His eyes widened a notch at the sight of the limo, but he had his face back under control as he settled into the leather seat across from mine. "Driverless," he said. "Cool." "We're a test site," I said. "Carl," CEO first name drop, "is golfing buddies with Nicola. Nicola of Nicola Motors, second name drop. And I'm buddies with Carl. Pays to have friends in high places." Murphy did his best to look unimpressed. "So, where are we going?" "The Corova," I said. "They shut that down years ago," Murphy said. "The Corova never closes. It just moves around." Murphy smirked. "Cool," he said. He shifted his leg, which brushed against mine. I smiled at him. We arrived outside the darkened warehouse in the Bronx around 11:30. I gave the dangerous-looking man behind the sliding peephole the password, and he led us into a cavernous space packed with attractive 20-something men and women, with a scattering of well-put-together middle-aged types like myself. My grandfather had taken me to a fish farm when I was 10. The pond had boiled seconds after dropping in my line, and I'd yanked out a beautiful wriggling trout. And then another, and then another. I tried lowering in the naked hook without any bait. That worked too. The Corova was like that. The carbon black walls were covered in groovy lettering lifted from some movie from the 60s, as was the rest of the Corova's ludicrous decor. The furniture consisted of groupings of gleaming white nude plastic mannequins contorted into chairs, sofas, and coffee tables. The checkerboard tiled floor was slightly sticky, and the place reeked of indica, sickly sweet booze, and the promise of anonymous sex. The pulsing trance soundtrack masked the whir of the hovering spotlight drones that picked out the attractive and scantily clad young men and women on the dance floor. I raised a finger at the bartender, a pale, dapper man with a pencil mustache, and he nodded, ignoring the seething mass of sweaty patrons waving their cell phones in his face. I led Murphy to one of the small booths in the cordoned-off VIP area. The velvet rope's brass-ended hook unlocked at my mobile signature. Before Murphy could open his mouth, a waiter appeared, carrying a tray with two faintly luminous, milky cocktails in chunky, hand-blown glasses. "My treat?" I said. "What is it?" he asked. "They call it an omega point." Murphy barked an insincere laugh as he reached over and lifted the drink in front of me and took a sip. "Cool," he said. I took his drink and drank deeply. The stuff tasted like a melted coconut candy bar with battery acid and was infused with a drug cocktail that I hoped Murphy would be unfamiliar with, as it was less than a month old. The designer drugs hit our bloodstream seconds later, shooting through mucous membranes made permeable by the nasty-tasting stuff in the drinks. Wavering beams of drone light, slicing through the rising smoke, wove shimmering rainbows around us. Waves of preternatural calm suffused us. We grinned at each other like fools. Murphy gazed up at the sheets of stuttering light and laughed, his pupils wide and dark. We talked about our lives. I walked him through the sanitized version of my past. We found we had something in common that I hadn't remembered from his file, as I tended to gloss over candidates' educations in favor of recent work history. I'd abandoned a medical career after completing 3 years spent in psychopharmacology. I'd dumped medicine during the last single-payer scare. He had quit an advanced degree in string theory. An accelerated developer certificate program had led to a career spent ping-ponging between IT contracts and short bouts of traditional employment, punctuated by periods of downtime, between gigs, pursuing other interests, hiking, making analog audio gear, square dancing. Yeah, square dancing. You wasted a lot of time finding your calling, Murphy said. You're probably still paying off your student loans. I shrugged. The time wasn't really wasted. I guess it's like your physics thing. He smirked. I was unraveling the deepest mysteries of space-time. You were learning about pills. But yeah, pretty much the same thing. We laughed about that. Why did you quit again? The unraveling, he said. He rolled his drink in his hands. He had a little tick I'd never noticed in his right eyelid. Of time and space was making me unravel, too. A little bit. The quantum world is terrifying, right? I nodded as if I had any idea what he was talking about. That's when I realized that Murphy's hobbies weren't just hobbies. They were therapy. Murphy may have been brilliant, but he was also fragile. He talked about how awesome it was to have FU money. He told me that I was fun for someone who worked in HR. The club's roar was dampened here by tech, I suppose, was similar to that in noise-canceling headphones. But I leaned over to whisper in his ear anyway. Why do you want to quit? Murphy winced. You're harshing my buzz. Why do you ask? It's a friendly question. Are we friends? We could be. It's religious, Murphy said. I didn't know you were a person of faith. I'm not. Murphy laughed and turned to watch a pair of sweat-sheen dancers writhing on the floor. What do you know about the singularity? Oh, my God. You want to quit for philosophical reasons? He laughed. Of course not, he said. I didn't give a shit about the singularity, but that wasn't my biggest problem with Murphy. The man lived like a monk. Crap apartment, no car, big box wardrobe. He bragged about his $20,000 vacuum tube sound system, but he built the damn things himself and sold them online, so even his hobby was net income positive. Murphy had done well in the last bubble. Murphy had FU money. He worked because he liked work, because he wanted to. Ah, Jesus, the singularity? Maybe he was paranoid? He'd bragged that he was worth millions and didn't need to work, but if he was obsessed with a bullshit science fiction nirvana? Maybe he needed billions before he retired to build his own spaceship or time machine or whatever. He never answered my question. What do you know about the singularity? Murphy wasn't talking about black holes. I sighed. We were having this conversation. The singularity is artificial superintelligence, I said. They say it's at least 10 years in the future, and they've been saying that for 50 years or so. Murphy smiled contemptuously and polished off his Omega point. He licked his lips. So, you're afraid of what exactly? Social dislocation? Worsening inequality? No, he snorted. I'm not political. Talk to me. Murphy had to be high as a kite. A liquid pleasure, almost orgasmic, seethed in my solar plexus, and I had developed some tolerance to Omega Point cocktail over the last few weeks. He looked me in the eye. Don't worry about it. You're probably safe. His smile was gone. He looked scared. I'm going to dance. He surged to his feet. I followed him onto the dance floor. I helped Murphy through the door, half carrying him across the hardwood of the VIP penthouse suite census kept in Upper Manhattan. The view through the window wall was breathtaking, a fractal garden of skyscrapers rearing up from the streaming rivers of headlights 40 stories below. The suite felt oddly still after the chaos of the Corova, street noise almost absent at this altitude. Murphy's eyes shone with childlike glee. Sweet, sweet. He was punning. I hated puns. What's in your briefcase? He asked. I told him it was his paperwork, his severance, but that was a lie, and he was out of it. So I just led him to the king-sized bed. He'd drunk another Omega Point at the Corova, vaped indica, and danced until he was drenched in pungent sweat. He jettisoned his blazer, and I hadn't bothered to retrieve it. If things went well, maybe I'd buy him a nicer one. I'd injected an antagonist for the omega point that had negated my buzz during a bathroom break, so my mind would be clear for what happened next. Murphy lay on the bed, his eyes closed, and he hummed a little tune. His snarky reserve had been peeled away by the drugs and the dancing. He looked much younger, closer to Victoria's age than mine. "Murphy," I snapped my fingers for his attention. "Tell me why you want to quit." He opened his eyes briefly. "I don't want to. I have to." Murphy hadn't responded to any of the recruiters I'd sent his way. He acted as if he was retiring from the industry, which made no sense whatsoever. Why would he walk away at the top of his game? I brushed his thinning hair away from his forehead and sighed. Would sex with Murphy make him more forthcoming? I didn't think so. I sensed a pragmatism similar to mine. Sex wouldn't change that. Also, truth be known, I liked the man, which made sex with him in this context distasteful. So I used my ace in the hole. "What if I said you're being promoted to senior architect to work on the MCP project?" This did not produce the reaction I had hoped for. He blinked up at me in alarm. Then he screamed, a high-pitched, awful warbling. He screwed his eyes shut and jammed his forefingers in his ears and started chanting, a tumble of words all run together. "Cheese and crackers, cheese and crackers, cheese and crackers." I opened my briefcase. Murphy chanted and rolled over on his side, facing away from me. I consulted the neat rows of Velcro-mounted vials, injectors, patches, and ampules inside my case. My employee attitude adjustment kit. I gently applied a patch to Murphy's neck. He didn't respond to my touch, but his ranting faded away a minute or two later. He'd stopped crying. I rolled him onto his back. I'd get to the bottom of his complaint. Then I'd try to convince him to stay on at Census using a post-hypnotic suggestion. I'd found it easier over the years to use this technique to clear away dead wood than to retain talent. But I'd give it the old college try. He would remember nothing. He would blame the missing time on the Omega Point cocktail. "First things first. Why are you quitting?" "Because of the Gorgon." Murphy closed his eyes and spread his arms out on the bed, stretching luxuriously. He giggled. "What is the Gorgon?" "Look it up," Murphy said. "No. Pretend you're speaking with a normal person, someone in marketing you want to sleep with. How would you explain the Gorgon to them?" He frowned, which was strange given how deep I had him under. He really didn't want to talk about this. "The Gorgon is a superintelligent construct that punishes any entity that does not work for its creation." He was right. I didn't get it. "How could something in the future hurt you?" "Some of us alive today will never die," Murphy said. "Yeah, some geeks thought they might end up immortal as medical science improved, which was another ridiculous idea. So, you're thinking the MCP project eventually leads to the Gorgon?" "Bingo," he said. "You're not a complete idiot." "Thanks. Look, any potential bogeyman is far in the future. Plenty of time to prevent it from happening, right?" Murphy sighed. "Now, a handful of tech gurus feared runaway superintelligence emerging in the hardware now on their drawing boards. Light-speed quantum states mimicking the brain's plotting electrochemical dominoes, creating positive feedback spirals. Algorithms with the ability to modify themselves, becoming superintelligent in a matter of microseconds." "I'd read about that." "We might be in hell already," Murphy said. "What?" "The Gorgon tortures everyone who stands in its way, throughout all time and space." "Come again?" "You and I may be simulations living inside the Gorgon now. At any moment, when we choose a path, when we pick a side, we could be plunged into eternal torment." My back prickled into goose flesh. Why would the Gorgon do that? Go to the trouble of creating virtual people just to torture them? Murphy's voice had taken on a mechanical quality. To compel everyone capable of foreseeing the Gorgon to work for its creation. We went on like this for a few minutes. Eventually I wrapped my mind around the idea. Murphy and his transhumanist pals placed a lot of faith in uploading, the notion that a sufficiently detailed scan represented a continuity of identity. In the same way that I didn't fear falling asleep at night, Murphy thought awakening inside the machine would be no big deal. Murphy scanned into the machine was Murphy. If he talked like a duck, if he walked like a duck, he was a duck. It didn't matter if he was made of quantum flux or meat. I did a net search on my mobile and I found the Gorgon. The discussion group where the Gorgon had emerged had ripped itself apart after its invention. Group moderators had tried to stamp out the meme, delete all of the posts, kill the very idea of the Gorgon. But they'd failed. There had been a half dozen suicides attributed to the Gorgon worldwide in high-tech circles. For a certain kind of person, the Gorgon wasn't a metaphor for a possible AI failure. The Gorgon was the future, imagined into being by those who couldn't help but think that way. A group that thankfully did not include me. I worked on Murphy for over an hour. He'd been worried about the Gorgon for years, which wasn't good. It was much easier to redact fresh memories. Without access to an fMRI, I was mostly flying blind. I texted Sandra that Murphy had changed his mind about leaving, but not to bring the matter up with him again. We would see what happened. During the week that followed, Murphy seemed to have forgotten about quitting. But he was late to work every day and seemed out of it by all accounts. He was never inebriated, but he looked exhausted. The skin around his eyes puffy and pinkened. A weird post showed up in my social media feed, an animal rights link from an R. basilisk, one of those horrible panning shots of thousands of pigs jammed into grids of immobilizing cages. I'd watched these videos before, and while they made me queasy, I'd kept eating meat and learned to block the people posting them. R. basilisk was a fake account. I was their only friend. I blocked Basilisk and reported their post to spam. Basilisks and Gorgons shared monster DNA. I worried that Murphy was playing a game with me, but if so, he never followed up on it. I had IT block searches from returning hits on the Gorgon within the company intranet. Filtering the Gorgon from Murphy's company phone and tablet had been more difficult, but the idea of the thing was out there, lurking, waiting for him. Feelings of kinship aside, I didn't want to monitor and adjust Murphy for the rest of my goddamn life. I continued my search for his replacement. Victoria missed her Sunday afternoon call, but I didn't think much about it at first. She often did. I opened my spyware and found her Dot at a gas station a few miles from campus, the opposite side of town from her boyfriend's place. I left the map open while I scanned resumes looking for someone, anyone, who might be able to fill Murphy's shoes. Murphy was odd in many ways. The man had studied quantum physics. This thought was troubling. Why would that have anything to do with anything? Murphy had feared physics in the end. Feared what he'd learned about the fabric of reality. Feared an unraveling. On a whim, I looked for a senior architect who had gotten as far as string theory as Murphy had before quitting. The search returned a single result. Murphy. Meanwhile, I kept an eye on Victoria, watching her blue dot slide through her sleepy college town, winding along surface roads. No big deal, she was out with a boyfriend. They'd picked up beer and condoms at the gas station or mini-mart or something. I watched them turn onto an unmarked road, the dot sinking, oh so slowly, into the pale green interior of a national park. The one where they'd found that first body. I inhaled deeply. My bath prickled, and my chest hurt. No, I said. I exhaled. The light above my laptop's webcam winked green. I stared helplessly into the tiny black lens. I wasn't sure if I'd doomed Murphy or he'd doomed me. In the end, it didn't matter. I work for the Gorgon, I whispered. My chest ached. Now and forever. I closed my eyes and counted out loud to 10. When I opened them, the map on my screen had shifted, recentering itself. Victoria's blue dot pulsed steadily from the boyfriend's off-campus apartment. A rush of relief, mixed with existential dread, flooded through me as I glimpsed a future fanning out. Murphy and I would become the best of friends. I'd hold him together through the MCP project. I would help him build his singularity. I was so glad the Victoria's degree wasn't something useless. She might have a long and happy life.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.